The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
And by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community, Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
November 11th, I will become 38 twice. I refuse to enunciate those other numbers.
We'll get a cake.
Bodo Schrader's what people call a character. Impish grin, yellowed mustache, a pack of Marlboros in his shirt pocket.
Oh, I'm checking her pulse.
Oh, she's a live one.
He came to the U.S. from Germany when he was just a kid, lived in Chicago, Massachusetts, later in Wisconsin, and eventually, he and his daughter Margaret landed in Manchester, New Hampshire. Just don't ask when.
How long have you lived in Manchester?
We came here in, I think, 79. We've been here 30 years, 40 years.
We came in the 80s, Daddy.
80s?
Yeah.
Memory is a sore point for Bodo and Margaret. It's not just keeping track of all the moves as Bodo's gotten older, but because Bodo is a Holocaust survivor.
Okay, psychologically, if we injure ourselves or we don't like the situation we're in, a human being's nature is to shut it down. And I believe a part of what happened with me was I just kind of shut it down.
This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next week, people across the world will gather to remember Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, when public violence against Jews and Jewish establishments erupted in Germany in 1938. But while many work to keep the memory of the Holocaust alive through education and events and museum exhibitions, Bodo and Margaret are on a more personal journey. A detective story, trying to piece together a childhood and family shattered by the Nazi persecution of Jews, and to reconcile Bodo's traumatic memories with a paper trail that doesn't always line up.
When my mother was taken, I was a year and a half, maybe two, okay, and they just left me in the apartment, basically left me there to die. And what really ticks me off is I wasn't even worth a bullet.
I met with Bodo and Margaret in a small conference room at the Jewish Federation of New Hampshire. Bodo sipped a cup of black coffee. Margaret sat with her hands resting on the edge of a stuffed manila folder. They both work in Manchester. Margaret is a mental health worker. Bodo manages a rooming house on Pine Street, a job he's held for more than two decades. But his story starts in Magdeburg, Germany, where he was the youngest of five children born to Karl and Margaret Schrader.
When you were growing up, did you hear much of that story, of your dad's history?
Not really. He told me little bits and pieces of what he remembered. I always knew that my grandmother had died in Auschwitz and that I was named after her and that my name was really important because of that. I also... Poor kid hates. I mean, it's Margot. Margot in a world of Margots, because New Hampshire is all French, so.
The broad details have been easy enough to recover, though astounding in their cruelty. In 1938, German authorities decreed that all Jews identify their heritage. Men were to add Israel to their given names. Women were required to add Sarah. Bodo's mother refused and was arrested several times. In 1942, the Gestapo came to their apartment and carted her off to Auschwitz. Bodo and his siblings were put into an orphanage. Their father, Karl, was a Gentile, a member of the Apostolic Church, and a Nazi soldier.
So your grandfather was a German soldier in the Nazi army married to a Jewish woman?
Yes.
And he was ordered to divorce her, and he refused.
My grandmother died in Auschwitz in 1943. They said the reason was pneumonia, but that's just what it said in the Auschwitz death book. A whole bunch of stuff was sent back to my grandfather, none of it was hers. It was just a bunch of random belongings.
For his defiance, Carl was sent to what Bodo and his daughter now believe was a labor camp. Margaret was still nursing Bodo when she was taken away, so memories of his parents were long buried by the time he arrived in the U.S. Bodo tried for decades to find out about his family and his past. Now he has access to something he never had growing up, Google.
Just on a whim, I typed in Margaret Schrader, and this picture came up of her and everything in German.
I have that picture. That's the first picture my father
ever
saw.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And you'll notice that she's got the Schrader nose.
When did you start doing all of this digging?
2 years now.
Yeah.
This woman has come up with God knows what.
Yeah.
She's a little magician when it comes to this research.
Since then, Margaret's uncovered more photos, inventories, affidavits, and other official documentation. Still, understanding how a baby made his way from an orphanage to a concentration camp to the United States is painstaking and painful work. After Bodo's father, Carl Schrader, was released from the labor camp, he collected his children from the orphanage where they'd been left, except for Bodo, who for some reason was left behind.
As parents, we make difficult decisions sometimes, and that was one of the decisions he made, was to leave my dad there. He felt that it was a better place for him. So he ended up taking the other children back to Magdeburg, Germany, with him.
Theresienstadt was like a holding pen for Jews being sent to concentration camps in other parts of the Reich. It was also an elaborate propaganda tool for the Nazis. They used it to convince foreign delegations and the International Red Cross that Germany treated its prisoners of war with dignity. They opened up shops and a cafe and a pavilion for musical performances. It was all a sham, of course. Roughly 33,000 prisoners died in Theresienstadt. Many more were deported from there to other death camps across Europe. Theresienstadt was liberated in May of 1945. And among the prisoners discovered there, 4-year-old Bodo Schrader.
We have an affidavit from a woman named Elsa Fischer, who is also in Theresienstadt, and she actually found him in a room by himself, uncared for. And he had a sign around his name that said his name was Bodo Schrader. Yeah, and that's how? I don't know.
That was the first recollection. Margaret dug up a picture of Elsa. She showed me the picture, and I said, Mutti.
What happened after being liberated from the camp is the murkiest part of Bodo's story. And while Margaret's research did stir up some long-faded memories for Bodo, memory is slippery. Both time and trauma alter our recollections of the past. And so Margaret has taken on an unusual role as a sort of fact-checker for her father's childhood experiences.
I was in Israel. I had to come back to this country, to Germany.
After Theresienstadt, Bodo spent some time in Munich with Elsa, or Mutti's family, but was eventually sent to an orphanage in the United States. In Bodo's version of the events, there's a plane crash, lost records, and being sent for a time to Israel and then back to Berlin. It's a narrative that Margaret gently puts aside.
To the United States.
Yeah.
So this is one of these memories that Dad has that I haven't been able to find proof of yet. So
well,
this
have,
is...
Because of the fact that Mia went to Ellis Island, my name is there.
Yeah, well, but that's the thing is, though, is that the date that you left Munich and the date that you arrived on Ellis Island is too close together for any of the other stuff to happen.
Right.
And the liberation, and so it's just, it's hard. I haven't been...
What is documented is that Bodo's life did not get much easier. He was adopted by a Jewish family in Chicago, but when he was just a preteen, Margot says the family set Bodo's adoption aside.
What do you mean your adoption was set aside?
Yeah, my father's adoption was set aside.
52.
Yeah, 52, because they found out that Carl Schrader was alive and in Germany, and he wasn't Jewish.
For Bodo, it was another rejection. He was angry and acted out, says he constantly got into fights. After again being abandoned, he had serious trust issues. He His short-lived adoptive parents sent Bodo to the Windsor Mountain School in Lenox, Massachusetts. It was run by a German woman, said to be one of Europe's first female doctors and a student of Sigmund Freud, Dr. Gertrude Bondy.
Scary woman. First time I met her, she pegged me in 15 minutes.
Pegged you as what?
Who I was and what my problems were, and kind of told me that if I didn't straighten out, she was going to hurt me. And I believed her.
So you learned to be scrappy. You were a survivor.
To this day, I'm that way, but I mean, what else is new?
The injuries of Bodo's past lay coiled and ready to strike just below the surface. But there's one significant part of his legacy that Bodo has not been able to access, something he wasn't old enough to own when he was in Germany, the very reason for his horrifying treatment, his faith.
I still have a hard time going to a synagogue.
Why?
I don't know. I have no idea whatsoever. I've gone. I know functionally what everything is, the Torah and you know, but I am Jewish. I do not deny the fact that I am Jewish. I'm actually proud of it. You know, but there's still residuals from all the time that I was in the various locations that don't let me feel comfortable.
Belonging and history are complicated concepts for Margot, too. She was astonished to discover previously unknown relatives while piecing together her father's story. A handful of descendants of Bodo's father, Carl Schrader, were still living in Magdeburg, Germany. One of them, a niece, speaks English. And no surprise, they're all on Facebook.
I would love to go.
You haven't been back?
No. Financially, I am incapable of doing that at this point. If the paperwork that she's working on comes to fruition, we should have the money to be able to go back to Germany.
Margot became determined to get her father to Germany to meet them. That's how she discovered something called the Claims Conference, a pool of funds paid out by the German government to compensate victims of the Holocaust. The application is no joke. So for help, Margot reached out to a community she and her father had never felt a part of, the Jewish community. Melanie Zalman McDonald, executive director of the Jewish Federation of New Hampshire, responded, and she's been helping the Schraders through the emotionally taxing application process for reparations.
I mean, it's one thing to fill in the blank with your name, you know, or your date of birth, but to, fill in the blank, type of persecution, you know, forced resettlement, separation from family, and to have all of your attachments to your application be things like birth certificates and death certificates and affidavits.
I have a page from the Auschwitz death book that has my grandmother's name on it. I have the manifest that shows my father traveling from Munich to the U.S. His name is there. His name is in the book for Theronstadt survivors. It's just so surreal.
The experience of putting the family story out there is a scary and exhilarating one for Margot. No matter what happens with the claims conference or the GoFundMe page she set up to help raise money to get them to Germany, Margot says all her research has helped her better understand her dad. And for Bodo, to get some perspective on his past.
In all the time that I have been on this earth, there's no reason why I should have survived whatsoever. None whatsoever. But for the fact that there were good people who stepped in in a very important way at just the right time. It's people like Melanie, people like Dr. Bondy, Elsa, who saved my life, basically. All of these people Without them, I wouldn't be here today.
Bodo, I really want to thank you for sharing your story today.
It's an honor. If time don't run out, I'll be able to get to Germany.
Will you send us a postcard from Germany?
Of course. She does the writing, so ask her.
Bodo, Margaret, and Melanie are hoping to send that application to the Claims Conference by the middle of November, just in time for Bodo's 76th birthday. You can see pictures and some of the research that Margaret has compiled over these past few years. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org. If you've ever driven on Route 103 heading up to Sunapee for some swimming or skiing, you've probably seen it. A great big rock right off the highway in Newbury with Chicken Farmer, I Still Love You, painted in big white letters. The graffiti has become a bit of a local legend, and it's been there for decades. As part of our series Only in New Hampshire, we answer your questions about the state. NHPR reporter Paige Sutherland picked up this one, The Mystery of Chicken Farmer Rock.
Every summer, Kelsey McNaught and her family take a trip up to Lake Sunapee. And every time they do, they play this little game.
When we pass the sign, we all scream, "Chicken Farmer, I still love you!"
Kelsey's always wondered, who wrote this message? Who was it for? And why a chicken farmer?
Why not a firefighter? Why not a regular farmer? Why not, like, a stone farmer? I don't know.
Kelsey's 28. And over the years, she's crafted her own story behind this. Man falls in love with a chicken farmer and then declares his love on the rock. Her 9-year-old son had a slightly different idea about it when he was younger.
He honestly thought that it was a man or a woman proclaiming their love for chickens. We've corrected him, obviously, but I still like to think that somebody loved chickens so much that they decided to, like, paint their love on the side of a rock in the middle of nowhere.
But Kelsey wants to know the real story, so she asked NHPR to investigate. And that's where I come in. Being a journalist for a few years now, mainly covering drugs and politics, I thought getting to the bottom of some rock graffiti, piece of cake. Not so much. After doing some research and making a few calls, I didn't really get anywhere, so I decided to jump in my car and head right to the source.
Driving through downtown Newbury right now, I have not seen the Chicken Farmer Rock yet. So I think I'm just going to have to pop in maybe to the library and have them point me in the direction of the rock. Town Hall Library right here.
Hello. How are you?
How are you?
Good. My name is Paige. I work for New Hampshire.
The town librarians I spoke with, Leah McBain and Laura Pizzone, both knew about the rock. They said everyone knows about it. In fact, the original rock was simply Chicken Farmer, I Love You. There's been a movie about it, poems written, sermons given, songs, bumper stickers, and...
We have the Chicken Farmer 5K race in the summer. It's just a little Newbury town race that they name after the Chicken Farmer.
The town loves their rock, but some outsiders didn't share that same passion.
Somebody made a complaint. They didn't like the looks of it, and they thought that it was graffiti. So the state decided, well, we're going to clean it up.
That's Dennis Pavlik. He's been the town administrator of Newbury for more than 2 decades. The state, he says, cleaned it up by painting a big red blob over the writing.
That set the residents of town into a orbit that immediately they were distraught not to see that. And then they were distraught that they never had a chance to have voice or opinion about it. So what happened was a lot of the people got upset and they started a petition.
In a town of under 2,000 people, hundreds signed the petition. And the state agreed not to touch it again. In the midst of all this, the writing mysteriously reappeared on the rock, but with a slightly different message. It said, "Chicken Farmer, I still love you." And since then, the words on the rock have stayed, even getting a fresh coat of paint by some secret admirer every few years. And yet, no one really seems to know the real story behind it. I heard versions involving a chicken farmer who went off to war, one of star-crossed lovers, one story painting the chicken farmer as a man, one as a woman, one about a mother writing it for her daughter before she left for college, and one about a veterinarian who fell in love with a chicken farmer. Some locals like Donna Maddie don't want to know the real story. They think it might kill the magic.
I'm a romantic, and I love to think of stories about why it's there.
I'm not the first person to try to get to the bottom of this. In 1997, Yankee Magazine thought they had figured out the real story behind the rock. They even called it the love story of the year. Yankee said the message was written for a girl named Gretchen Rule. She now goes by Gretchen Hamill. She lived across the street from the rock, and her family had chickens. In the 1970s, she was in high school, and according to the story, the message was written for her by a secret admirer.
I had some idea of who it might have been, but it's just nice to think that someone out there likes me enough to put that on the rock.
Gretchen never confronted that person and wouldn't tell me who she thought it was. So I kept digging. The town librarians didn't know who the secret admirer was. The longtime town administrator said he had no clue, and local town folk weren't sure either. But in all my conversations, one name kept popping up as someone who knows all the facts. So I went to find him.
On top of the house on the right. This must be it. We shall see.
This man went on to tell me that there's one true story behind the rock, and he knows it. But he's not telling anyone. He says he was sworn to secrecy. The reason you're not hearing his voice is he wanted to keep his promise and stay out of it. Still, it was proof that the truth is out there.
It's so interesting that something like a rock would have people seal up so much. I mean, now I want to even know more of this story, because why aren't people talking about it? It's just a rock.
There was one other person in town who people said might have some answers. Her name is Doris Newell. She grew up in the house adjacent to the rock and raised her kids there. She's 82 and has since moved to the senior living facility down the road.
When I was a teenager, that rock was covered with foliage, all trees all around it. And I used to sit on that rock and watch the traffic go by. And when the Blue Line Express went by, I knew I better get home because supper would be ready.
Doris says she noticed the graffiti when her children were in school.
So, and it just appeared one day?
Just appeared. And they would come and renew it. It would be sort of dull in the morning or in the evening. And then by the next morning, it was all brightly painted again. I never heard anybody. Could have been anybody, but I don't know.
Another dead end. With my two best leads now crossed off the list, I didn't know what to do. So I did the most logical thing. I went to go talk to people who live near the rock. But first, I had to find it.
I see some rocks. Nope. That is not the chicken farm rock. Is it? Nope. Oh, there it is. That really sneaks up on you. Almost missed it there. With the shrubbery, you really can't see it.
I then went over to the house right across the street, the one where Gretchen Rule, the girl with the secret admirer, once lived. Lynn Long now lives there, and has since the 90s. She bought the home from Gretchen's parents, Louis and Greta. She says she knows the real story, and she was willing to spill it. So spoiler alert, if you don't want to know, block your ears. The story goes like this. Greta had a good job working for the state, and her husband Louis was a probation officer. but had to retire early for health reasons. That didn't mean he stopped working.
He did sheep. He did Christmas trees. I think he may have done a little sugaring. There used to be a cabin here, so they rented cabins out during the summertime. I mean, it just kept going on and on and on. And it's a lot of work.
So here's Lewis, who's supposed to take it easy. And instead, he's working just as hard as he did when he worked in probation. He even decides to start raising a flock of chickens. And one day, Greta had enough, and she tears into him for taking on too much. She immediately regretted it.
Greta went out there and she painted that and said, oh, it just showed up one morning. I don't know where it came from. It just showed up. It was her apology to Lewis.
Because she was bugging him about being a chicken farmer.
Right, and she couldn't say anything that she was the one who did it because she worked for the state, and that's in the state boundaries. And it should cost her her job.
And that's how the message got there. Chicken farmer, I love you. It was a love note, but also an apology. And from the sounds of it, their relationship was just as solid as the rock itself. Greta and Lewis were married for 65 years. Around town, people say you could just tell the two were deeply in love. As her children put it, the couple was joined at the hip. They ended up moving into a retirement home in Concord. They've both since passed. Lynn says she heard the story directly from Greta when she moved into the house, and she says they even left behind some chicken feeders too. When I told Greta and Lewis's daughter Gretchen this version of the story, she was shocked and not quite sure it's true. She says her mother never told her that. You never asked your parents?
No. It just never occurred to me that one of them would use spray paint on a rock on a highway. I would have been appalled and disappointed, quite frankly, that it wasn't to me.
This all started to make more sense. Why would a high school girl raise chickens? She didn't. And why would people be so hush-hush about something as silly as writing on a rock? Well, Greta could have lost her job, or worse, could have crushed her youngest daughter's dreams that this love rock wasn't written for her. With a story to now tell, I sat down with our listener, Kelsey McNaught, to finally share it with her.
What do you think? What's your thoughts?
That's really fascinating, and I like that story a lot more than my own story. And it's fascinating because my husband, part-time, he likes to keep bees, and I can't stand that he keeps bees. So he also does all these odd jobs, and I like that story a lot more.
Kelsey said she doesn't plan to share the story with her husband. He wants to keep the mystery of it alive. That's something I heard from quite a few people in town, including the town administrator.
But, you know, that's what the glory of this whole story is because nobody really knows. I mean, they can say they know, but we don't know that to be really true, do we? That's probably why it's a great love story, is because no one's absolutely 100% sure.
I guess that's how local legends get made. After enough time passes, the details don't seem to matter as much as the mystery. There is one thing the whole town can agree on. They don't want the rock to go away. It's their town love story. For Only in New Hampshire, I'm Paige Sutherland.
If you've got a New Hampshire mystery that needs solving, let us know. Submit your questions to our Only in New Hampshire series. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Today's episode was produced by Taylor Quimby with Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Ben Henry. Maureen McMurray is director of the Brooklyn to New Hampshire Hospitality Fund. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Ending Satellites, and Ikimashu Aoi. I'm Virginia Prescott.